ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Arts in 30, your weekly digest of arts and culture news from across the globe. I'm Sky Kirkham. If you're from one of the smaller cities in Australia, like my hometown of Brisbane, and you want a career in the arts, the story has tended to be that you have to move to Melbourne. And look, guilty, this show does come to you from NAM. In fact, there are even songs about it. Please don't move to Melbourne. Please don't leave standing. But according to a new report tabled in the Victorian Parliament last week on the cultural and creative industries, it has never been harder for Victorians to make a living in the creative sector. But why are things so hard in the supposed artist's paradise? Georgie Purcell, who chaired that inquiry, will join me soon. And we'll hear from one of the companies who are dealing with the reality of these challenges firsthand. Melbourne's La Mama Theatre survived fire, they survived the pandemic, but this year they've had to pause performances to try to figure out how to build a more sustainable future. But first, the headlines with Claire Nichols. Claire, we're focusing on Victoria today, but the New South Wales government have made some big budget announcements as well.
Yeah, the New South Wales government budget includes $380 million for the film and digital games sectors. That funding includes $100 million to support the search for a new film studio production facility in New South Wales. That'll be the second in the state. Currently, Sky, there are four known sites vying for the approval. The film studio that currently exists is owned by Disney. It's regularly booked out for that studio's own film slate. So it's believed that a second site will be a really important thing for expanding the state's screen sector. Elsewhere, Adelaide has announced an additional $13 million over 10 years for arts and cultural funding, and Western Australia has announced a $2.75 million investment in live music.
Look, every bit matters, so It all adds up. And Claire, some big news from your patch as well, with the shortlist of the Miles Franklin out.
Yeah, look, this is arguably the most prestigious writing prize in Australia. There are six books on the shortlist this year, and the big news is that Michelle de Kretser is in the running for, if she wins, it'll be her third Miles Franklin for her novel Theory and Practice. She's already won the Stella Prize this year, so I'd say her chances are good, Sky. But joining her on the shortlist are Brian Castro for his novel Chinese Postman, Compassion by Julie Jansen, Ghost Cities by Xiang Lu, Highway 13 by Fiona McFarlane, and a debut novelist on the list, Winnie Dunn, shortlisted for Dirt Poor Islanders.
And if Michelle de Kretser does win, I think that'd make it the second year in a row that the same person wins the Stella and the Miles Franklin, right?
That's exactly right. Alexis Wright won the Stella and the Miles last year for Praiseworthy. Will this become the new trend, Sky? That's what we'll find out.
Very interesting. And I imagine people can hear some conversations with those authors on the book show.
Yes, keep following us on the ABC Listen app. We're going to have a whole show dedicated to the Miles Franklin shortlist very soon.
Excellent. Claire, what else is making news?
So this is a real nightmare situation, Sky. Think about museums. Think about all us clumsy people when you listen to this one. A tourist has damaged a crystal-studded chair by Nicola Bolla that was on display at the Palazzo Maffei in Italy after they sat down on the artwork for a photo.
No.
I know. So the couple responsible fled the scene, but they were captured on video. The museum's director, Vanessa Carlin, said, "Sometimes we lose our brains to take a picture and we don't think about the consequences. Of course, it was an accident, but these two people left without speaking to us. That isn't an accident."
Don't sit on art, people.
Don't
touch art.
Sit on art. I mean, it's always that moment, right, when you think, is that chair art or is it a chair? I always pause.
If it's studded with Swarovski crystals, probably
don't
art.
Sit on it. A Victorian venue is going to charge punters a $1 levy to help cover the rising costs of public liability insurance. And this is thought, Sky, to be an Australian first. The co-owner of Suki Lounge says, "I don't want to whack up the booking fee because it needs to be educational. I need the customer to understand where it's going." Before 2020, the venue was paying about $15,000 annually for public liability insurance, and the latest bill was more than $60,000.
And that's a story we've been hearing across the country on this show.
Yeah. The Lockhart River Arts Centre is expected to be put into liquidation after two counts of failing to lodge annual reports with the registrar. The Arts Centre is 30 years old. It's produced internationally recognised artists. And a commentator has told ABC Digital he believes it is the state and federal government's responsibility to ensure that the Lockhart River Arts Centre survives. Janet Lawrence has won the Ravenswood Australian Women's Art Prize for her photograph of moss taken during a trip to Antarctica. More than 1,900 artists entered work in the prize, which comes with a $35,000 cheque. And finally, Skye, the hugest congratulations to our very own Rudy Bremer, Teresa Tan and Daniel Browning, who have won the Mid-Year Walkley Award for Arts Journalism and Arts Criticism for their coverage of Archie Moore's work, Kith and Kin, at the Venice Biennale.
And a huge congratulations indeed to Rudy, Teresa and Daniel for their work on that story and their work on all of the stories they do across the ABC. Thanks, Claire. You can catch Claire Nichols with The Book Show every Monday at 10 a.m. on Radio National or any time at all on the ABC Listen app. On ABC Radio National, you're listening to Arts in 30. I'm Skye Kirkham. And from Perth to the Lockhart River, we've been hearing stories of artists and arts organisations struggling under the economic pressures at the moment. Even Victoria, with the highest cultural participation in Australia and a reputation as the art state, has been feeling the pinch. Originally due to be finalised last year, the Victorian Parliament's inquiry into the cultural and creative industries has now been handed in, looking at the impact of the federal government's revive policies, regional arts and culture, and the sustainability of national arts training organisations. Taking in 42 submissions, 2 days of public hearing, dozens of findings, it's a comprehensive look at arts and culture in that state, which may also hold some important lessons for the rest of the country. Georgie Purcell, who's a member of the Animal Justice Party, was the committee chair for the report, and she joins me now. Georgie, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
Now, this report found that almost every adult in Victoria had engaged with at least one cultural activity in the last 3 years. What does that actually mean in practice, though? Has everyone just seen a TV show, or does it reference a more direct engagement with what's going on locally?
This was part of the inquiry that I probably found the most engaging and interesting, because we engage with the arts and cultural and creative industries basically every single day, and sometimes we don't even realise it. When you walk down the street or catch a tram, you see people with their AirPods in their ears that are likely listening to a podcast or listening to music on Spotify. We walk past street art every day. We walk past performers. Every single time we do that, we are engaging with the arts. And I think it's part of the reason that perhaps it's become so underappreciated, because it's just part of our everyday life and we often don't think about how it came about.
Do Victorians, beyond the earpods, beyond the TV, are they getting out to events as well, or is part of the problem that consumption has become more of a personalised thing?
Something that came through in the inquiry is that the physical attendance in the arts is starting to struggle, particularly post-COVID and post-lockdowns, and particularly in a cost of living crisis. So obviously ticket sales are a driving factor behind people no longer being able to attend events or shows or gigs, and that sort of change in practice that has come about in the past few years and shifting of priorities. Even if people do want to pick up those habits, it's often hard for them to do so.
And one of your key findings was that since the pandemic, I'll quote from the report, the cost to produce and present work has significantly increased. Mm-hmm. Why is that? What were you hearing from the people on the ground?
There's a range of reasons why this has happened. A number of witnesses believe, and the committee believes, part of it is driving costs, production costs, and that's been compounded by the cost of living crisis. So one example that we heard about is the cost of renting spaces, the cost of ticket sales, and all of these increased prices that is, you know, making it more and more inaccessible. Something that was explored very heavily and came through very, very regularly is grant funding not necessarily increasing, and some areas of the arts not feeling as if they've gotten their fair share or that they're appreciated by the government and needing that to change in order for arts and creative industries to continue to thrive in our country.
Well, I mean, yeah, that definitely is something I've been hearing as well, that funding hasn't increased in line with indexation for most organisations. Is that something that should change? And I guess following on from that, is that something you think will change?
Look, it's something that I think should change. Whether it will change is another story. And something that is abundantly clear is that state and federal governments are kind of passing the buck between each other about who is responsible for supporting the arts. There definitely was a feeling among witnesses and submissions that the federal government had been better at this than the state government. Now, of course, we know particularly in Victoria where this inquiry was undertaken, the budget is pretty tight right now, and Victoria is in a lot of debt, and that has resulted in the government making cuts and choosing areas in which to save money. And we find that these areas are often the ones that suffer the blows of that. Something as well about the these industries is that we found that they seem to be considered by many as a nice to have, not a need to have, which is something that we need to overcome, because the arts is so much more than that. It creates a cultural and social fabric between so many communities, particularly right now when social cohesion is so important. And of course, it creates connections and communities, and all of that has so many flow-on positive impacts for other sectors of society.
How does the funding and support for the arts then compare to other similarly important sectors of the economy? Because I think there is a perception that the arts takes a lot of money from the government, because we see that money in direct grant funding, for example, whereas some of the funding for other sectors can be a bit more hidden. But do you have a sense of how the arts compares to other similarly sized sectors?
Look, I don't have a direct comparison of, you know, directly how it compares. What I would say is there is a whole lot of problems with perception behind the arts. There doesn't seem to be much pushback or disappointment when funding is given to other areas such as sports and sporting events, which are just as important to Victoria's economy. I mean, we see it with the Grand Prix. There's about to be hundreds of millions of dollars invested in a new pit lane for the Grand Prix every single year, and that seems to be just accepted. But when it comes to the arts, I think that there are some politicians and parts of the community that deem the arts as, you know, not as necessary, and that's something that we really need to overcome. There's definitely a funding problem, but there's also a perception problem as well. And, you know, artists and creatives give so much to us, not just in terms of things for us to consume and enjoy, but lessons. And, you know, there's always a message behind the work that they do. And like I said, that flows into other parts of society and I think makes us better as a state.
You mentioned before that state and federal governments are sort of passing the buck to back and forth about who is responsible for the funding. But as someone in a state government body, do you have a clear sense of where that split is, of what the state should be doing versus what the federal government should be doing?
Look, I think they both have a role to play, and it became very, very clear that, yes, the state government very much considers a large part of the responsibility on the federal government. The federal government thinks that the state has a role to play as well. Something that is clear is that funding has not increased from the state government, and there hasn't been as there was a real sense that there hasn't been as much consideration or investment from the state government, particularly in sort of smaller, more grassroots areas of the arts. We heard from a range of different theatre companies and production companies who had success in receiving funding and support from the federal government but couldn't even get their foot in the door with the state government, and that's something that really needs to change. It's not just about the big events, the ones that we all know about. It's about those local ones in our communities. And particularly for me as a regional MP, it was really, really clear that the regions in particular and country areas felt left behind. And it's so important that that changes, because those regional areas, they're the ones that can often feel the most sort of social isolation or disconnect from their communities. And the arts does such a good job at, you know, bridging that gap and bringing people together. And something that's happening as a result of that, we heard from a range of witnesses, is a sort of this accepted reality that if you're a creative or an artist that lives in a country area, you will inevitably have to move to a metropolitan area like Melbourne in order to advance your career. And that's something that we desperately need to address. There's a number of regional MPs who sat on that inquiry who heard from people in our communities that were really struggling because they just couldn't get the governments at any level to listen to their stories.
Mm. And Georgie, finally, the report now goes to the government for their response. What are the key things you'd like to see come out of this work that you've done? Are there sort of one or two central policies you'd like to see change?
Yeah, something that I'd really like to see change. The government has 6 months to respond to this report, and we're really hoping, first of all, that they do that within the time period, because it's only 18 months left of this parliament. So if they are going to do something, they need to address it quickly. I'd really love to see them acknowledge the funding issues and the distribution of funding, more importantly as well, to ensure that all levels of the arts sector are getting their fair share. I'd really love to see the state and government, state and federal governments work proactively together and see this as a shared and joint issue that needs addressing rather than passing it back and forth between each other. And of course, we did make some findings and recommendations around bringing certain jobs back to Victoria and back to Melbourne. We heard from the public broadcasters about sort of the role that New South Wales and Sydney plays, which is, of course, very important to their economy. But, you know, bringing parts of that back to Melbourne as well, I think would be a wonderful thing to see and would mean so much to so many Victorians.
Georgie, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Georgie Purcell there. Georgie is a representative in the Victorian Legislative Council for the Animal Justice Party and was the head of the inquiry into the cultural and creative industries of that state. And you can find a link to their findings on our show page. You're listening to Arts in 30 on Radio National. Let's hear now from one of the groups at the coalface. For nearly 60 years, La Mama Theatre has been presenting new Australian works to audiences in Melbourne with a fairly unique model. The artists involved receive at least 80% of the ticket sales. This year, after missing out on a second consecutive round of Creative Australia funding, the company has had to pause all productions while they work out what changes are needed to make the company independently sustainable. So beyond funding rounds, what's led to the pause? And what will the future look like for La Mama and for independent theatre across Australia? Caitlin Dullard is the CEO of La Mama Theatre. Caitlin, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Can we start with a quick history of La Mama? For those who aren't familiar with your work, what sets La Mama apart from other theatres, other groups?
Sure. So La Mama was founded in 1967 by Betty Burstall, who came back from New York, the coffee culture theatre that was really exciting over there, which was about new voices and about really taking the intensity of the theatre experience and the elitism, just throwing that out the window and having a really a culture that's based in hospitality, in human connection. It was at the time about pioneering and supporting the Australian voice, which was evolving, but the theatre culture hadn't quite caught up. But it was also about creating an environment where artists could thrive and really talk to their audiences in an intimate, personal way. So that's the kind of culture that we've developed over almost 60 years. It's about that intimate, raw human connection, a space where people can talk about ideas and think about the work without the pretense of some of the kind of really established, the establishment of some theatre. Certainly that was true in Melbourne in the 60s. It's obviously come some way, but still that kind of subculture.
So why are you in a space now where you've had to take a gap year? What's occurring? Because you've gone through, you know, over the last decade, there's been fire, there's been the pandemic lockdowns. Why has 2025 been the year that's seen you have to close your doors?
Yeah, look, I think a lot of arts organisations would agree that the post-COVID era is the era of reality. Actually, many of us thrived in a kind of weird way throughout COVID. But certainly we've had a rough few years. We've had this beautiful new building rebuilt after the fire, which is going to service for the next 60 years and beyond. And then really the catalyst for pausing performance for the year was the announcement of we didn't get Creative Australia funding, operational funding, which was the second time. And obviously that was deeply disappointing for us, but also a message to us. And we took the moment to, instead of, we found out in December and we spent kind of weeks working out how we could possibly make the budget work with the offering that our artists needed, that they had come to expect. And we just couldn't make it work. And so rather than putting forward a really, from my view, diluted, depressing version of what we really could and should be doing at a time that artists need us, we made the decision to spend the year putting all of our resources into finding a way to make sure that our operations can match the building that is that and the needs of our community. So the COVID boom finished. It's crazy, I know, but the reality is we did get support through that time. And now is a new era. You know, philanthropy's dried up, government funding has stagnated, and it's no longer viable to have the same model as it has been for us for decades. So we really need to put energy and time and resources into working out how to find a way.
Caitlin, La Mama only takes 20% or less at the box office of the shows that you present. It's an admirable choice. Is it a sustainable one? Is it one that you need to consider?
Look, for me, it's an essential one. As anyone working in the arts right now knows, or engaged in the arts, it's the independent artists who are doing it the toughest. It's really becoming very hard for them. Society's changes over the past 60 years have impacted them in really serious ways. And it's my view that it's our responsibility to support them and to find a way for them, because that's our role. That's what we exist for. And so while I have lots of people telling me that it would be a better way to go, to be a venue for hire or to change the model, that's not the point. That's not who we are or what we do. We exist to serve that community. That community needs message of hope. That community needs a place to go, to have freedom of voice, freedom of expression, to make art. And for me, turning around and saying, oh, we're a venue for hire, it just throws out all of our value and all of our worth, and I feel like taking this year to find another way. You know, there's a lot of money in the world. It's not in the arts, but there's a lot of people who really value what we do, and there's taking the money out of the pockets of the artist feels like a really bad direction to go in.
Mm. To what extent are some of the problems you're facing La Mama specific or even state specific? What are you hearing from your peers in the industry?
Yeah, look, it isn't a fruitful time in the industry. There's lots of fear about the future. Lots of organisations are finding the current climate quite challenging. There's certainly still really exciting work being made and really motivated artists like who are not going to give up. But absolutely, I mean, I think it's kind of been a long-term erosion that's kind of generational, that's the value of what we do seems to be a bit taken for granted, and that kind of slow kind of not financially valuing what we contribute to society. I think there's lots of organisations and players in the game who are working really hard to find other ways, and certainly need support to do that.
When you look at funding models outside of the government, one of the major sources is philanthropy, although you were saying that that's dried up a little at the moment. But one of the challenges we've seen for companies over the last few years is that philanthropists seem to want more editorial control than perhaps they once did. Is that something you're having to consider as you're looking at your situation at the moment?
Oh, absolutely. Moving forward, I mean, we've got really great relationships and that hasn't been an issue for us yet, but we're absolutely committed to artistic freedom and making sure that we're engaging in the right kind of partnerships that that don't compromise that. I mean, that's just not really an option for us. That's, again, it's who we are. We're about the artistic voice and the freedom. So, yeah, we can't enter, we can't compromise that. It's a disservice, again, to everything that we do and are.
Well, 6 months into your pause, into your planning for the future, how's it going? Are you feeling hopeful for the future?
Absolutely. I mean, this is the thing. I'm engaging with very optimistic artists all the time who are making really exciting work. So we have residencies this year. So we've got 88 different groups working on new Australian work. And every second Friday, we come together, we have a sharing, and we see three different groups and what they've come up with in the 2 weeks they've had in the space. And I leave every other Friday feeling utterly hopeful and inspired by the future of theatre in this country. There's really exciting makers despite the challenges. And then I go back to the desk for 2 weeks and, you know, navigate a challenging budget and navigate all of the challenges. But absolutely, I'm hopeful. We're making, I think, really strong and smart progress that's responding to the realities of the world that we're in without losing the heart and soul of our legacy and who we've been. We absolutely can't compromise on that. It's so special. It's so needed. And we've got to get that balance right with celebrating all of that and being really realistic about our future.
Well, Caitlin, good luck and thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
Caitlin Dullard is the CEO of La Mama Theatre. You're listening to Arts in 30 on Radio National. I'm Sky Kirkham. And every week, we invite an expert from across the ABC's music networks to showcase one special song for you, our track of the week. And this week, Sara Glaidis from Triple J Unearthed joins me. Sara, welcome. What's our track of the week and why is this the one that we should be listening to?
Hello, Sky. We're heading to Northeast Arnhem Land today with the solo project. And it's a debut project as well from a guy named Terry Goliath. He has started this project called Drifting Clouds. And he mixes this soul, funk, synths with kind of like a bush band feel. And it's all spoken in Yolngu Mathur, one of the languages in Northeast Arnhem Land. Really, really beautiful stuff. I heard a rumour from another band from Northeast Arnhem Land, King Stingray. These guys told me, one of the guys in the band told me that Terry from Drifting Clouds created the song All in Garage Band, which is incredible.
The song's about the song lines of his area, right? The sea and the waves.
It's exactly that. The lyrics describe traditional song lines. We've got the sea and the waves and how the currents over there become stronger and rough and like and tough, as he calls it, in Arnhem Bay. So that's really, really beautiful. I think the way that you can carry a story through song in an Indigenous language is so different to the Western world, and there's a beauty to it that's unlike anything else I've ever listened to before. So this is a really gorgeous listen for your Wednesday.
Well, I can't wait to hear it. But before we do, I do have one question for you. Triple J has announced the hottest 100 of Australian music. So I want your quick pick. Who are you hoping makes the cut?
So the hottest 100 is of Australian songs, and we have to pick our favourite songs, not songs that we think are like a massive hits. I think I'm going to put an oldie in there. It's going to be Mental as Anything, Live It Up. But I will.
Classic.
I'm definitely going to be slipping in some Kylie in there as well.
Nice. Well, some classic tracks to go back and listen to. But for now, let's get some new music.
Yes.
Sarah, can you throw to our track of the week?
This is Drifting Clouds. You're listening to Arts in 30.
Thank you.
Boy Poor Way There by Drifting Clouds, the track chosen by Sarah Gladys. And that's all the time we have for today. Arts in 30 is produced by me, Sky Kirkham. C. Benedict is our executive producer. Ross Richardson, our sound engineer. And if you've got a story you think we should be reporting on, let us know. artsin30@abc.net.au. I'm Sky Kirkham, and I'll catch you next time here on Arts in 30.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.